It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from up here on Signal Hill in Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 43 degrees, according to our temperature gauge on the tiny back porch behind the station, 37 degrees out at the airport, and they are clocking calm winds and a barometric pressure of 29.22 inches. We're looking for a slight chance of rain before 1 p.m. today, then isolated showers between 1 and 4 p.m. Cloudy skies today will gradually become mostly sunny with a high near 46. But look out for those southerly winds gusting up to 30 today. Coming up on the Midday Report, a dog is rescued from the Laura. Also, a man who died over the weekend in Anchorage was one of the survivors from the Scandies Rose. And the NTSB has issued their report on Unalaska's fatal 2019 plane crash. We'll hear details.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The conservative-leaning U.S. Supreme Court appears ready to strike down a New York law that says you have to have a license to carry a concealed firearm in public. The court's decision is expected to have national repercussions. An NRA New York affiliate and two gun owners argue the law violates their constitutional rights. Chief Justice John Roberts also questioned the state law.
You can say that the right is limited in a particular way, just as First Amendment rights are limited. But the idea that you need a license to exercise the right, I think, is unusual in the context of the Bill of Rights.
Justice Elena Kagan, a liberal, had this exchange with Paul Clement, the lawyer defending New York's or opposing New York's gun law.
There are 50,000 people in one place. They're all on top of each other. We don't want guns there. That's you couldn't, the city or the state couldn't do that?
I think they might well be able to, because again, you can't get into Yankee Stadium without a ticket.
New York Solicitor General Barbara Underwood said in defense of the state law, concealed guns need to be regulated to protect public safety. She says a proliferation of firearms on New York City subways, quote, terrifies a great many people. The Virginia gubernatorial race dealt Democrats a blow as they set their sights on the 2022 midterm elections. This morning, Terry McAuliffe conceded to Republican newcomer Glenn Youngkin. Republicans are also bolstered by a strong showing in New Jersey, where the governor's race is in a dead heat, so close that the two candidates are swapping the lead as votes continue to be counted. From member station WNYC, Nancy Solomon reports.
The difference in votes cast for incumbent Democrat Phil Murphy and Republican challenger Jack Cittirelli can now be expressed in hundreds. That in a state with 6.5 million voters and a million more registered Democrats than Republicans. Some precincts have yet to be counted, and it's unknown just how many of the 500,000 mail ballots have been tallied. Even if Murphy prevails, it was a terrible night for New Jersey Democrats. The state Senate president might lose his seat, as well as another 8 to 10 Democrats in the legislature. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon in Maplewood, New Jersey.
China is sharply increasing its nuclear force and could have some 1,000 warheads by 2030. That's according to a just-released Pentagon report. We have more from NPR's Tom Bowman.
That 1,000 nuclear warhead figure China apparently hopes to reach more than doubles the Pentagon's estimate from just last year. That's still far fewer than the U.S. nuclear stockpile, which stands at some 4,000 warheads. The Pentagon report also says China's overall defense modernization will provide credible military options against Taiwan. Still, the top military officer, General Mark Milley, says it's unlikely China would invade Taiwan in the next 2 years. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
It's NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
When the FV Laura ran aground on Monday, the boat's 8-month-old puppy jumped into the water and was thought lost. The Coast Guard mounted an hour-long search for the pit bull lab mix in the morning of the accident, but with no luck. But as KMXT's Dylan Samard reports, this story has a happy ending. Just a quick correction. The Laura did not capsize on Monday morning, but ran aground.
The fishing vessel Laura capsized Monday morning after striking rocks near Sitkleedak Island at around 7 a.m. The 4-person crew safely boarded a life raft, but Grace, the vessel's puppy, had already jumped into the freezing water and was presumed lost. A Coast Guard UH-60 had swept a 5-mile area, but to no avail. They turned back to nearby Air Station Kodiak to return the crew to dry land. The next day, another Coast Guard helicopter crew went over the area, looking for evidence of a fuel spill from the FV Laura, and perhaps holding onto a shred of hope that Grace might still be alive. Miracles sometimes do happen in Alaska. By the grace of dog, she was on a nearby beach.
So the dog was directly in front of the boat, off to the side a little bit, on a narrow beach with about 20 to 40 foot cliffs all around her. And I was able to find a way. We ended up landing. I was able to find a way to sort of scramble down that cliff to grab her.
That's Petty Officer Rafael Aguero with the United States Coast Guard. He's the rescue swimmer who got that puppy off the beach.
She was definitely in a little bit of a shock, definitely hypothermic. So I walked up to her, and I knew she was going to be okay. She wagged her tail a little bit. And then I went, picked her up, and scrambled back up the cliff, back to the helicopter.
Aguero and his crew found it amazing to find her unharmed.
To go through those conditions and spend 36 hours alone in the wilderness like that, on the beach with the cold, and she was otherwise okay from what I could tell. But it's absolutely incredible that we found that dog.
The dog was reunited with her owner at Air Station Kodiak around 1:30 p.m. According to Aguero, Grace is an 8-month-old, 80-pound pit bull black lab mix, and she's doing just fine. Unfortunately, the ship hasn't fared so well. The wreck is still on the rocks, and according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, a 5-mile-long oil sheen about a mile from where the Laura hit the rocks has been sighted. Spill responders say they are monitoring the situation. The vessel's owner estimates that there was about 3,000 gallons of diesel aboard. For KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Dylan Samard.
A man who died over the weekend in an Anchorage motorcycle crash was one of two survivors of the fatal sinking of the fishing vessel Scandies Rose. That's according to the Anchorage Daily News. The crab boat was lost on New Year's Eve 2019 west of Kodiak Island with 7 crew members on board. 2 fishermen were rescued wearing survival suits in the life raft, but 5 others were never found. 36-year-old John Lawler was one of the survivors and had lasting trauma from the tragedy, according to an online fundraiser started by his family. On Sunday, Anchorage police were called to South Anchorage, where Lawler's motorcycle had lost control in a roundabout, the ADN reports. Lawler died at the scene. Faulty wiring, lax oversight by regulators, and an inexperienced crew were all factors leading up to Unalaska's fatal 2019 plane crash. That's according to the National Transportation Safety Board, which revealed its findings on Tuesday after concluding its investigation. Investigators found that the Raven Air Saab 2000 aircraft overran the island's short runway because an anti-skid brake malfunctioned due to a bad wiring job. That caused the tire to burst on landing and released brake pressure on 2 of the 3 remaining wheels. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy says the pilot's decision to land amidst strong tailwinds was questionable, as was federal aviation regulators approving the Saab 2000 for landing in Unalaska, despite it falling short of safety guidelines.
The investigators found that the Saab 2000 could have landed safely had it not been for a braking system failure and an anti-skid system failure.
The pilot and co-pilot were inexperienced on the island route. Both men had barely 100 hours of flight time into Unalaska, far less than the 300 hours required by the route's former carrier, Pennair. The 5-member Transportation Safety Board unanimously approved 10 safety recommendations to avoid similar accidents in the future. Homendy says Six of those are for the FAA, three for the European Union Aviation Safety Agency, and one for Saab, the aircraft's manufacturer.
The only way we're going to prevent a future accident is by making sure these recommendations are implemented, and we'll do all we can to make sure that's done.
The final NTSB report will be published on their website in coming weeks. Raven went bankrupt in the months after the crash. It was subsequently rebooted with a similar name under new management and ownership structure from a different investor group. Yesterday was the last day of the Alaska Legislature's fourth special session. There wasn't a single meeting. Lawmakers remain far apart on the state's long-term budget and permanent fund dividend policies. One thing that might help, oil prices remain high.
Ketchikan Independent Representative Dan Ortez has been looking at a proposal that would rewrite the formula for setting permanent fund dividends while also adding taxes. But with the recent price of oil raising state revenue, he says the case for taxes is harder to make.
It's always going to be a lift for legislators to come to consensus on added revenue or a tax, passing a tax. And with this new revenue forecast, I think it makes it that much more difficult.
The new revenue forecast is a preliminary report the state released on Friday. It forecasts higher oil prices will add more than $1 billion to the budget this year. And if those prices hold up, that $1 billion would come in every year. That could be enough money to pay for Governor Mike Dunleavy's PFD proposal without a new tax or substantial state budget cuts. The catch? We're talking about the price of oil. And as Ortez notes, it's never what you forecast it to be. He says he's not more likely to back Dunleavy's PFD proposal, considering the state's other needs and how important it is for him to protect the permanent fund.
To put a long-term fiscal plan on the basis of a recent projection on oil price increases holding, I just don't think that's sound policy.
While the House Majority Caucus that Ortez is a part of has largely opposed Dunleavy's PFD proposals, most minority caucus Republicans support them. Nikiski Republican Representative Ben Carpenter says that while oil prices are unpredictable, the legislature has to begin somewhere in analyzing policy choices.
You know, it's been a number of years since we've had real high oil prices, and maybe people have forgotten what it's like to have those large revenue streams coming in from the oil companies.
Carpenter hopes that more revenue, even in the short term, can allow legislators to consider the long term.
When we don't have enough money to go around for the budget and difficult decisions have to be made, that raises the blood pressure of all the decision makers. It makes conversations more difficult and emotions get high.
State Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Fechter worked on the forecast. He says the state is more confident in the short-term forecast. Fechter says the state knows that oil prices can turn on a dime, but he says that even short-term price increases can bring long-term benefits.
A higher oil price means higher royalties, which means more money is getting deposited into the permanent fund, which benefits us in those future years.
Dunleavy also understands that oil prices are volatile.
I've been here long enough to experience it, since the 80s.
But he said a day before the forecast was released that some lawmakers skeptical of relying on high oil prices were already opposed to his proposals.
Nobody knows what tomorrow's going to bring. We didn't predict a pandemic. We can't predict earthquakes. We understand that. We do our best guess and our best estimates.
Fairbanks Republican Representative Bart Laban says those estimates can help. But at the end of the day, the legislature will have to weigh the state's needs each year, regardless of the price of oil.
Today, we're north of $80. A year from now, we could be under $50. I mean, I just don't know how to predict the future trends in the price of oil.
The first day of the next legislative session is January 18th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
14 musical acts will participate in an international Indigenous music festival based in Juneau. Alaska Native musicians will join several others in the virtual festival called Rock Ock. KNBA's Trip Krause talks with one of the festival organizers, Kachung Stephen Blanchett, about putting together the lineup.
Can you sort of like give a synopsis of like both what you're doing now, but also maybe how you got there?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I'm in Bamiwa, one of the members of Bamiwa, and we've been performing almost 30 years now. We're coming up on 30 years together. And, you know, one of the things that we've really got to know, realize and notice is that there's few opportunities for Indigenous artists. And, you know, we've performed at music festivals all around the world. And, you know, a lot of these festivals, we're often put off to the side, right? You know, kind of the Indigenous or the world music group will have their own kind of, you know, stage off to the corner of the festival. And that was typically the norm. And it was rare that we actually performed on, you know, the main stages. And one of the things that we've always talked about was the need to just create our own, because there aren't those festivals that really engage with Indigenous artists. And one of the things we talked about was, you know what, we just need to make our own.
It's being billed as being virtual, but also you're bringing people into Juneau to actually film stuff for it. So can you talk a little bit about what the makeup of
absolutely. You know, we were in denial, right? We're like, oh, we felt like there was an opening there, like things were changing a little bit in July, and we had made the decision, okay, let's do this. It looks like things are changing. We got the numbers are going down. We got the people are getting vaccinated up, and we were all vaccinated up, and so we made the decision that we're going to have it an in-person festival. So we went ahead and like connected with the folks and bought the tickets and all that. But then, you know, as we all know, the Delta variant came in and it just kind of changed things. So we made the decision to go fully virtual, but we had all these tickets bought. And so we worked up a system where we're having all these amazing artists flying in. We have 10 groups that will be in person here in Juneau. And we have them scheduled out throughout the day. And we have all the virtual like hosts. We have 14 different hosts that will be introducing the 14 different bands.
It's really interesting. The lineup is a little bit of a mix of Alaskan artists. So there's Bumua, there's Arius, Hoyle Air Jazz, Whitney Hungman, Byron Nikolai. But then there's also like a really nice international flavor too, like Stadino's Res Kids. And
yeah, Stadino's Res Kids, Puro Face, Superman, Albino Mbe, Pantayo. You know, one of the things about this festival is that, you know, when we look at it in a way of like bringing Indigenous peoples together, right, and really doing this intentionally. So we're opening it up with some protocol from the Ani here, from the land here, of the Akwan. The Ak is the name of the tribe that is from Juneau, and there's Taku as well. But the Akwan is the folks that will be kind of the main drivers in putting in protocol. But we also have the vision and the mindset of like those cultures and peoples around the world that many people wouldn't think of as Indigenous, but those places that have been fighting for their languages, fighting for their traditions, and have been colonized, those are people that we're also going to be, you know, inviting. So we have Pantayo, who's an all-female Filipino group, who don't identify as Indigenous, but they have their traditions that they're fighting for and have been colonized by outside, you know, influenced by outside colonizers, right? So they really appreciate that we're doing something like this that brings to light those things that happen around the world.
It's been a really interesting conversation the last few years, seeing that conversation that we've been talking about for, you know, decades and generations finally hit a global consciousness. But like to be able to see some of the creativity that comes out of that has been really interesting.
Yeah, it's a beautiful time that we're in right now. You know, I mean, not just the consciousness and us coming together in the world, right? This world's really coming, getting smaller, right? We're just connecting in many, many ways and more ways. But, you know, there's also this explosion of Indigenous pop culture that's happening right now. We're in the midst of something that's happening. You know, in my 30-year career, this is it feels different. You know, it really does. You know, we have one of our artists, Yatsin, he created this beautiful, like, mega installation, Indian Land, you know, and, you know, that thing blew up viral on social media. And it's, I mean, there's been so many things happening around that space, and it's just beautiful to just to take that land back, right? And that acknowledgement of indigenous land. You know, Juana Chasing Horse, you know, she was at the Met Gala, yeah. And, you know, she blew up. I mean, she is like a supermodel now. I mean, you have Sterling Harjo with Res Dog, man. This is, you know, it really feels like there's just a shift in, like, the consciousness and, like, the recognition of indigenous peoples. And, like, you know, not, you know, that's not this, like, Hollywood, you know, Hollywood, you know, vision of, like, who we are. But it's, like, we are doing this. And we're on the stage, and it's happening. And it really feels different, you know. And I'm super excited that Rock Ock is, like, part of that.
Where can folks find more information about Rock Ock?
Oh, it's definitely on our social media. So if you just, you know, look at all the what's, there's definitely a buzz going on, but it's Rock Ock, you know, Rock, ROCKAAKW. And the website is rockockfestival.com. And so rockaakwfestival.com.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Alaska's 2021 salmon fishery ranks third in the record books. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
It's a fish trifecta for Alaska's 2021 salmon season. The fishery produced the third highest catch, fish poundage, and value on record dating back to 1975. The preliminary harvests and values by region were released this week by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The catch of nearly 234 million salmon had a dockside value of nearly $644 million, nearly 46% higher than last year. All Alaska regions saw salmon earnings double or nearly triple, except for the Kuskokwim, Yukon, and Kotzebue, where values decreased. At Southeast, for example, the value to fishermen topped $132 million compared to just $50 million last year. Prince William Sound salmon at nearly $122 million was up from about $72 million last year. Cook Inlet salmon values crept up to nearly $19 million, a $9 million increase. Kodiak salmon values topped $51 million, an increase of more than $24 million. At the Alaska Peninsula, the salmon value this year topped $67 million, a nearly $51 million gain. And at Bristol Bay, the value of nearly $249 million was an increase of more than $108 million over last year. Prices for all salmon increased across the board, with Chinook averaging $5.82 a pound, a 75-cent increase. Sockeyes averaged $1.34 compared to just 76 cents last year. Pinks at 37 cents was a 7-cent increase per pound. The values don't reflect post-season adjustments or bonuses to fishermen. The final value of the 2021 salmon fishery will be determined next spring following reports from buyers. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the third day of November, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 9:28 and it will set again at 6:16. That's going to give us 8 hours and 48 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 36 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 51, that was set in 1915 and 1924, and our record low was 11, set in 1985. And currently, the sensor array has popped up to 43 degrees out at the airport, and they're getting a light rain out there with south winds to 12 miles per hour now. And that is in line with what is called for this afternoon, a chance of rain before 1 p.m., then isolated showers between 1 and 4. Cloudy skies are supposed to gradually become sunny with a high near 45 and those southerly winds to 15 gusting to 25. For tonight, a slight chance of rain showers after 7, mixing with snow after 1 a.m. Partly cloudy skies tonight with a low around 32 and those southerly winds gusting to 25 tonight. For tomorrow, they're calling for isolated snow showers before 7 a.m., then isolated snow showers after 1 p.m. Partly sunny skies otherwise, though, with a high near 42. And those southerly winds are going to come down to 10 tomorrow. Glancing at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 1:23 this afternoon. That will be a 9.7-foot tide here on the east side, followed by a low tide at 7:48 this evening of -0.7 foot. Our high tide for the middle of the night will be at 2:04 a.m. and be 8.5 feet. And our low tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will be at 7:46 in the morning and be 0.9 foot. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 1:58 this afternoon, almost 2, and it will be a 16.1-foot tide in Larsen Bay. You'll have a low tide at 8:26 p.m. That's going to be a -1.8-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 2:35 in the morning of 14.7 feet, and a low tide tomorrow morning on the west side at 8:31 in the morning. That'll be 0.6-foot tide. Mariners, for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side offshore, you have a small craft advisory through Thursday. South winds to 25 and seas to 10 feet right now. Those winds are going to come down to 20, but seas remaining at 10 feet tonight. And southwest 15 tomorrow, but seas coming up to 11 feet on our east side tomorrow. For the Shelikof, small craft advisory through tonight. Southeast 15 becoming south 25 this afternoon. Seas building to 6 feet this afternoon. For tonight, southeast 30 diminishing to 20 knots after midnight. Seas 6 feet subsiding to 4 feet after midnight. And for Thursday, south 20 in the morning becoming variable 10, seas 3 feet on Thursday in the Shelikof. The City of Kodiak and the Kodiak Island Borough Cooperative Relations Committee will hold a meeting today. That's happening at 4 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. The meeting's open to the public, and agendas and meeting packets are available at the City of Kodiak website. To request paper copies or an additional information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. Also, the Kodiak City Council will hold a special council meeting on Thursday. The meeting will begin at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow. Elected officials may be participating via audio-video conferencing. The public portion of the meeting will be web-streamed, and the web-streaming link and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. For those who wish to request printed meeting materials or have any more questions, contact the clerk at 486-8636. Also tomorrow, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is having its Kodiak Regional Planning Team meeting. That's happening Thursday at 9:30 a.m. by Zoom video conference. The topics of the meeting will be the 2021 seasonal hatchery and monitoring operations, salmon harvest summary, ongoing research project updates, and sport fish seasonal updates. So a lot to be heard on there, a lot of information. For additional information, including the web link, please contact KRPT Chairperson Nathan Weber at nathan.weber@kraa.org. That's Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, dot Weber, W-E-B-E-R, at kraa.org. The meeting is open to the public, free of charge, and public participation is encouraged. The Kodiak Public Library Association has two openings on their board of directors. Join them and help them continue their mission of providing support for the Kodiak Public Library. The board meets monthly. KPLA is also looking for help constructing bases for several little libraries that they'd like to put up around town. Little libraries offer free books for anyone to encourage reading in the community. Just contact them at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. That's kpla.alaska@gmail.com. Or give them a call at 486-6498, extension 2, if you'd like to be part of KPLA.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.